Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is going to be a fascinating hour. You'll be glad you listened. Lynn Olson is our guest. She has been with us before, and she picks moments in history that are absolutely riveting, and not as much has been written about those moments in history as should be. Her latest book is Those Angry Days, Roosevelt, Lindbergh, and America's Fight Over World War II, 1939 to 1941. And she starts the book, a soft morning, April of 1939, Charles Lindbergh was summoned to meet with FDR, arguably the only person in America who equaled him in fame. Images of these two men had been indelibly impressed on the nation's consciousness for a long time. Less than 7 years after his history-making flight, the 32-year-old was the only person who could match the 52-year-old's president in national popularity. They were strong-willed, stubborn men who believed deeply in their own superiority and had a sense of being endowed with a special purpose. And they had wildly different ideas about what America's role should be in coming to the aid of France and Britain. Interventionist, isolationist policies, and I kept thinking as I was reading this book, what if Charles Lindbergh's ideas had won? Lynn is the author of this book. She's also author of the wonderful book, if you haven't read it, I highly recommend it, Citizens of London, and she has spent 7 years with AP working as a national feature writer in New York. She was a foreign correspondent in the Moscow Bureau of Associated Press, political reporter in Washington. She's worked for the Baltimore Sun, taught journalism as an assistant professor at American University. Another of her great books, The Murrow Boys, named one of the best books of 1996. She's also author of Freedom's Daughters, the first comprehensive history of women in the civil rights movement, and she is the author of Troublesome Young Men, The Rebels Who Brought Churchill to Power and Helped Save England. Lynn Olson, I've been so looking forward to speaking with you. You just know how to pick these moments in history and write these fascinating books about them. You're always so on target to me.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's a pleasure to be back with you again.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. And it's one of those books, I know we shouldn't do this too much, but I kept thinking the whole time I was reading this, what if Charles Lindbergh's ideas had won? What if they had won? What if we had stayed out of all of this? What if we believed him and he ran for president and he won?
Well, you know, that's a great what-if question, but the truth is actually, in reality, Charles Lindbergh would never have run for president. I know
Right.
Philip Roth wrote a wonderful book with that kind of idea in mind, The Plot Against America. But Charles Lindbergh was a very solitary, isolated guy who didn't really like politics. He was only in it because he thought very strongly that we should stay out of World War II, but he made very clear that he would never run for public office.
Was he, as Franklin Roosevelt said at some point, and tell me how he said this, a Nazi?
Yes. No, he was not a Nazi. Franklin Roosevelt did say that. He said that in a letter to one of his cabinet officers. And I think he truly believed it. Charles Lindbergh was not a Nazi. He was pro-German in many ways, but he did not sympathize with the Nazi system, and he certainly did not sympathize with how they treated Jews, etc. But, you know, there's a fine line here. He very much thought Germany was going to win the war right from the beginning. I mean, he actually was in Europe, when Hitler was coming to power and started his march across Europe. And he truly believed that the German military might was overwhelming, and that France and Britain had absolutely no chance of standing up to it. And so he basically said that the Western European allies should come to a negotiated peace with Germany.
The other thing that's really remarkable about your book is this huge, intense debate with all of these fascinating characters that took place during these years, and yet we don't remember very much of this. People don't write about this. It's not in our national consciousness now, and I'm wondering why.
That's really true. I think part of it is that when Pearl Harbor occurred, and when we got into World War II, the war was such an overwhelming experience, a defining moment in this country's history and the history of the world, that it just kind of swept up everything that went before it. So these 2 years were very, very important in our history. Basically, we were trying to figure out what we were as a nation. But World War II just kind of swamped it, and nobody really thinks about it that much anymore.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the characters involved in isolationist, interventionist. Some of the people who went on to become president, actually, were very much isolationists, at least early on, weren't they? People like John F. Kennedy, Sergeant Shriver.
Yeah, that's one of the most interesting things I found when I was doing my research. I did not know about this. The main isolationist organization in the country, the most effective, the most influential, was called America First, and it was created in the summer of 1940. And I had always thought of it as a conservative Midwestern organization that, later headquartered in Chicago. But as it turns out, it was actually founded on the campus of Yale University. There was a very big anti-war movement going on among college students to the idea of the U.S. getting involved in the war. I mean, we think now of World War II as, you know, the good war, the just war, the war in which we had to get into in order to help rid the world of Hitler. And that's all true. But back then, back before we got into the war, it wasn't that clear. And a lot of college students, millions of college students, were absolutely opposed to us getting into it. And so this group of young Yale students in 1940 founded America First. And among the founders were Gerald Ford, who went on to become president, Potter Stewart, who went on to become a Supreme Court justice, Sergeant Shriver, who was the first head of the Peace Corps, and a guy named Kingman Brewster, who became later president of Yale, and very ironically, he became an American ambassador to Great Britain. And among those who supported America First, they weren't founders, but they were supporters, was John F. Kennedy, who was a Harvard senior at that point, Kurt Vonnegut, who was at Cornell, and Gore Vidal, who was a prep school student in New Hampshire. So all these people, you'd never in a million years expect them to be isolationists. But as I said, college students, you know, they knew that they were going to be the first on the front lines, and they also felt, you know, we had gone into World War One, 20 some years before. They felt it had been a disaster. You know, we went into that war to help save the world for democracy, and instead democracy gave way to Adolf Hitler. So they just thought, we're not going to do this again.
Right. And what about FDR? Did he know early on that we were going to have to play a significant role in this battle because of the evil of Hitler? What was he trying to balance? Because as many people, probably more in America, felt that we should not be involved in doing much of anything. And so he had to persuade a reluctant public. But was he reluctant as well or not?
He was reluctant. The country was heavily isolationist in the beginning of the period I write about, 1939, certainly into 1940. And FDR had not really paid much attention to foreign policy issues up to that point. I mean, quite rightly, he had been focused on domestic issues from, you know, the beginning of his presidency in 33 up until the late 30s. I mean, what he was trying to do was to get us out of the Depression and did a pretty good job of it. So he really wasn't focused on foreign policy. He wasn't really focused on Hitler coming to power. And he had done very little to educate the American public about that perhaps we would have to do something to stop Hitler at some point. So when everything heated up, when the war began in September 1939, he was really desperate to help England and France. But, you know, I'm not sure he actually thought that we would get into the war. He thought it was absolutely essential, certainly that Britain survive. Once France went down, once the rest of Western Europe was conquered by Hitler, Britain stood alone. And FDR was absolutely determined, or you know, he wanted to keep Britain afloat. You know, he was feeling his way like the rest of the country was, I think.
Right. You also had, and I wonder how important Churchill's rhetoric was and the relationship that he had with FDR. Churchill knew how to give a heck of a speech.
Oh, boy.
Didn't he? Yeah, he really did.
He really did. And those speeches, you know, not only rallied his own country to stand against Hitler, but they inspired America. They inspired the United States. And I think his speeches and his behavior, the way he was just the most incredible leader, really helped start bring American public opinion around from its isolationist views early on until, you know, it really became interventionist, by the time we actually got into the war. And Churchill was absolutely key to that. No mm-hmm. question.
I found this interesting. Give us details. Roosevelt and his supporters, assisted by a covert British intelligence operation, embarked on a campaign to destroy the credibility of isolationists in this country, their influence and their reputation. What did they do?
The British sent over in early 1940, May and June of 1940 were kind of the crux, the incredibly important months. In this whole 2 years, because that's May and June, that's when Western Europe was defeated for the most part, and that's when Britain basically, was faced with a huge threat to its survival. And so Churchill sent over a man named William Stevenson to New York to start a very covert, top-secret group in New York called the British Security Coordination. And what it was aimed at doing was basically getting the U.S. into the war by any means possible. And what they did, there were hundreds of Brits in New York who belonged to this group, and they did all sorts of things, much of it dirty tricks kinds of things. They spied on isolationists. They tapped the phones of American isolationist members of Congress. They managed to get British propaganda into American newspapers. They even forged documents to help them in their fight. And what's so interesting that's interesting in itself.
Yes.
What's interesting about it is that this is all done with the approval of FDR. I mean, remember, we were a neutral country at this point, so what they were doing, much of what they were doing, was illegal,
mm-hmm.
but FDR, they were helping FDR basically in his attempt to discredit the isolationist movement, which is what he wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. And now let's go to the isolationist movement, and I found Lindbergh's visit to Germany, in which he describes what their military power is, was a fascinating journey, and some of what he said really wasn't quite accurate.
That's right. He and his wife, Anne Morrow Lindbergh, and their son, the son that was born after their first son was murdered, kidnapped and murdered, went to Europe in the mid-30s. Lindbergh desperately wanted to get away from all the publicity, all the press. He hated the tabloid press, which he felt was responsible, really, for the death of his son, his first son. So they moved to Europe, and they spent the next 4 years in Europe, living at first in England and then in France. And during that period, he was invited by the Germans to come and inspect their air force, the Luftwaffe, with the idea that he would be so impressed with it that he would basically tell the world that it was supreme and that nobody else could defeat Germany. And it worked. I mean, he went and toured aircraft plants and airports and saw the modern planes that the German Air Force had, and he was incredibly impressed by it, and he fell for the propaganda that they put out that they were basically unbeatable, but actually that wasn't true. They weren't. I mean, they certainly were good, but they weren't as good as the Germans tried to make it appear. But Lindbergh thought they were unbeatable, and basically he told the world, he told the U.S., he told Britain and France that there's no way anybody could defeat Germany.
Hmm. And why did everybody listen to Lindbergh? He did this amazing thing, and he had been through a horrendous tragedy. But as you say, he wasn't somebody who was going to run for president. He was just this hero, and he was worshipped in this country. And I don't understand the adulation completely.
In the 1920s, which is when he made his flight, it was a very kind of cynical time. It was after World War One, there was a big loss of idealism. People were out for a good time. And by the end of the 20s, or toward the end of the 20s, people were looking for another hero. Mm. I mean, they had had it with, or a lot of people were. There were no heroes at that time. And then this young, handsome, unassuming, polite pilot does this incredible thing that nobody had ever done before. And it just swept the country and swept the whole world by storm. I mean, from that day in 1927, he became the most famous man in the world. And he basically kept that status, you know, for the really until almost he died, I mean, until when he died. I mean, he was, I think, probably our first true celebrity. He hated all that. He hated all that. He hated the attention, and he tried to withdraw from it. He tried to prevent the publicity that was always surrounding him. And when he did that, it just made the press and the people more anxious to know about him. So he had that incredible, I don't know, charisma that, you know, as you say, you wonder why.
Right.
But it was that feat and who he was, I think, that made people really interested in his views and in knowing something about him.
But then I was flabbergasted. I had never heard this before, Lynn. You write at the end of the book, which is why I asked you, was he a Nazi? Because it seemed as though he was in agreement with some of the principles, Hitler's, you know, the Aryan race and all of that.
Yeah. No.
From 1957 until his death in 74, you write, he led a secret life that was breathtaking. And by golly, it was breathtaking in its audacity. He fathered no fewer than 7 children by 3 different women, all of them German, and made frequent visits to his children and mistresses at the homes he provided for them. What in the world was that all about?
Well, who knows? I mean,
really?
Charles Lindbergh is one of the strangest, most conflicted men I have ever, you know, read about or written about. It's impossible to tell. You know, even his children here in the United States, nobody knew about this until it was revealed in well after his death and just a few years after his wife's death in the early 2000s. I think it was 2003, 2004. And it had been a secret, a total secret, until one of those German families discovered the children in one of those families discovered after their mother had died the true identity of their father. And his kids here in the U.S., you know, were just stunned, obviously, by this. And, you know, they couldn't figure it out. I mean, I don't think anybody ever knew anything really about Charles Lindbergh. I suspect, because nobody knows why he did this. He had always said he wanted 12 children, and with Anne, he had 6, including Charles Jr., who was killed. Mm-hmm. And then with these 7, it was 13, but with 12 living, so he had 12 children. And you're right, he did have this thing about the German race, the Aryan race. And but, you know, as I said, nobody really knows. Nobody knows, you know, why he did this.
Yeah. The story between Anne and Charles is also riveting, isn't it? You write quite a bit about that. She must have just had the hardest time with her family and where they stood on this and who he was to her, and he wasn't really very kind, and what she thought politically. What a tough marriage.
Oh, it was, you know, she was caught right in the middle of this fight, this debate that went on. She had grown up in a very wealthy family in New York. Her father had been a partner of J.P. Morgan and then went on to become an American ambassador to Mexico and then a U.S. senator. So she grew up as part of the Eastern establishment, East Coast establishment, which was very pro-British and very interventionist. And her mother actually was one of the leading activists for intervention. And her sister, Constance, who was really her best friend, was married to a Brit who, as it turned out, was one of the top British propagandists in New York. So what he was doing was trying to get us into the war, the U.S. into the war, the very thing that Charles Lindbergh was trying to prevent. And she supported, Anne supported her husband in his isolationism, although I don't think she ever really truly believed in it. And she was just torn apart through this whole thing. It was an emotionally awful time for her because she and he, Lindbergh, were ostracized, shunned. by many of the people she had grown up with, you know, her closest friends, you know, some of her relatives, not her immediate family. Her mother and her sister worked very hard to keep the closeness there, and they managed to do that, but you know, cousins, et cetera. So it was really, really tough for her.
And we thought Thanksgiving conversations were difficult nowadays, huh?
Exactly.
Imagine them then. Wow.
Oh, boy. Yeah, it just shows that you know, that nothing really changes. I mean, I think in many ways this is a much more savage debate, you know, mm-hmm. much more divisive a debate than we're having now. But it's actually quite similar.
Mm-hmm. The Great Debate is what it's been called. Our guest this hour is the author of Those Angry Days, Roosevelt, Lindbergh, and America's Fight Over World War II, 1939 to 1941. It's a heck of a book. Lynn Olson is the author of this. She's also author of Citizens of London, The Americans Who Stood with Britain in Its Darkest, Finest Hour. She's written a number of other books as well. So let's go to your phone calls. Our lines are filled right now, but there will be openings as we move along. 800-486-8655. Our email, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, we always like to leave whatever writings you put there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Lynn Olson is our guest this hour. The book is Those Angry Days, and we go to phone calls for her. Saeed in Green Bay. Hi.
Yes, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if your guest has read the book Buried by the Times. It is relevant to the question we're talking about in terms of influence on American public opinion in that time, how the political tendencies of the editorial board of the New York Times influenced how they reported the news of the Holocaust. In fact, they did. They tended to minimize and kept from the American public emerging news about Hitler's Final Solution and other news of the Holocaust. And because of the influence that the New York Times had on the rest of the media, this resulted in a massive underreporting of the emerging news from Europe in 1939 to 1945 regarding the Holocaust.
Lynn, let's get a response on that. Lynn?
I have not read the book. I have heard of it. You know, it wasn't just the New York Times. Of course, the New York Times is a very influential newspaper. But most of the media back then did not report very much on the Holocaust. One reason, I mean, I know a little bit about this because I wrote about Edward R. Murrow, the great CBS journalist, and his group of correspondents. And they didn't either. I mean, there was news coming out, but it was either not believed or kept kind of quiet by the governments, the U.S. government and the British government. And yes, you're right. The press did absolutely fall down on the job. But I think a lot of it was journalists didn't believe that it was happening. I mean, it was coming out thanks to the Polish government in exile in London and a couple of other outlets. But it was not widely known. Obviously, there were no journalists in Poland, which is where most of the death camps were. And so, you know, there was really no access to this information. In hindsight, everybody made a mistake. There's no question. But I think you have to realize what the situation was at the time. It was very, very difficult to know about this.
And yet, you write at some point in the book, I don't know if it was a letter she wrote, that Anne Morrow Lindbergh knew about what was going on with Jews.
She talked about what they were doing in the late 30s, the persecution of
Kristallnacht
in Germany. Yeah, the Holocaust really hadn't begun then. I mean, the wholesale deliberate murder of Jews didn't really start until the early 40s. But there's no question that Jews were being persecuted in Germany. I mean, Kristallnacht in 1938. I mean, you would have to have been blind and deaf not to know that. And it bothered her. It didn't seem to bother her husband that much. I mean, he wrote about it, you know, kind of cold-bloodedly. He said, basically said that this is really stupid of the Germans to do this. You know, this is not the right way to handle the problem. So he was not in favor of what they were doing, but he certainly did not condemn it on moral grounds.
Thanks, Bill, for the call. Let's go to John in Richland Center. Hi, John.
Hello, Kathleen and Lynn Olson.
Hi, John.
Hi. My relatives and my grandfather was a captain of the German army.
Uh-huh.
He took his Jewish woman to New York in 1925 because he could see what was going on with the political upheaval. And I want to give credit for the upper elite. He was educated in Heidelberg. You got Churchill, FDR, Kennedy, the Fords. But Hitler and Stalin were jackbooted thugs from the working class.
That's true. I mean, 1925 is very early because Hitler hadn't even come to power, although he was making sounds. But your uncle was very prescient in getting out of there. There's no question.
Mm-hmm. We need to go back a little bit to FDR and talk about the path that he took to convince the American public that we needed to be involved in this. When you had huge public opinion polls saying that America, most Americans believe that we shouldn't be doing anything. We talked about his doing campaigns against his adversaries, but what else did he do to turn the tide? Or was this just events that turned the tide because of what Germany was doing?
It was a combination. As I said, you know, he really wanted to help Britain. I don't think he ever really wanted us to get into the war in terms of sending troops.
Mm.
Until Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
But he was trying very hard to get American public opinion to accept sending aid to Britain so it could survive and basically hold off the Germans by itself. Now, that would never have happened, quite frankly. Britain was too weak to do that. But he was somewhat cautious and hesitant in proposing bold steps along the way. But what he was not cautious about, he welcomed people to push him. He welcomed ordinary Americans. He welcomed citizens group to push him, to kind of force him to do things that he might be reluctant to do otherwise. And that happened, just to give you a couple of examples, in the summer of 1940, we sent 50 old American destroyers to Britain to help them. Initially, Roosevelt was very resistant to that, but a couple of citizens' organizations that were determined to that were pro-intervention and were determined to help England mounted a public relations campaign throughout the country to get people to support this idea, and they did. And so that helped, you know, creating that public opinion, that favorable public opinion, helped Roosevelt then in going out and saying, okay, yes, we're going to send these destroyers. The same thing was true with Lend-Lease, which he, a wonderful program, you know, one of the great successes of his presidency in January 41, which is when he proposed it. And the idea was a massive aid program for Britain and then the Soviet Union when it got into the war on the Allied side in 1941. But it was very controversial, and again, he enlisted the help of these citizens' organizations, these pro-interventionist organizations, who mounted a similar PR campaign and again got the public to support one of the president's programs. So while he was not terribly bold in pushing for this initially, he really allowed or kind of encouraged others to make him do it.
And let's talk about some of those others, because this is an interesting cast of characters as well. The playwright and writer Robert Sherwood, Adlai Stevenson was involved in this, newspaper editor William Allen White.
Yes, absolutely. William Allen White was one of the main figures in these groups. William Allen White is one of my favorite characters. He was the editor of a very small town newspaper in Kansas, but he also happened to be one of the most prominent journalists, most famous journalists in the country. He had been he had been friends with every president since William McKinley, so he was very, very influential, particularly in the Republican Party. And he founded, actually Roosevelt encouraged him to do this. He founded a group which came to be called the White Committee, and it was one of the two main interventionist groups. And established chapters all over the country and, you know, enlisted hundreds of thousands of people in this fight to help England. William Allen White did not want to get into the war. He thought we could stay out of the war by giving aid to England. But he was very, very influential. Abby Stevenson was a lawyer in Chicago who worked with the White Committee. And there were a whole lot of others very well known. Robert Sherwood was one of the more kind of radical interventionist, if you will. He wanted us to get into the war immediately, and he was very. He and William Allen White had words because at one point Sherwood called anybody who disagreed with the interventionists either an imbecile or a criminal. I think, and William Allen White, who was, you know, a very genteel, civilized guy, said, you know, there are a lot of people who are against us getting into the war. Who are doing it for very strong reasons. You know, they truly believe that we should not get into the war. So the two of them, Sherwood and White, kind of typified the kind of you know, discussion and debate that was going on at the time. Mm.
And what about Wendell Willkie? He was an important person in persuading people and in aligning himself with a Democrat.
Right. I mean, Wendell Willkie, if there's a hero in my book, it's Wendell Willkie. Wendell Willkie was an ex-businessman who was very strongly isolationist. He was very popular in the country. He had become a very popular public figure. And he ran as a dark horse for the Republican presidential nomination in 1940. Nobody expected him to get it. First of all, while he was popular, he was unknown in politics. And he also was an interventionist. He strongly believed that we had to help England, and then later thought we should get into the war. But his beliefs just went against everything the Republican Party stood for. The Republican Party at that point was heavily isolationist. So nobody expected him to get the nomination. But he had this kind of popular movement behind him that grew and grew and grew. And so by the time the convention was held in Philadelphia in 1940, the galleries were packed with Willkie supporters that had poured in to Philadelphia from all over the country, and his supporters were sending, you know, hundreds of thousands of telegrams and letters to the delegates. And so at the end of the, you know, it was an incredibly exciting convention, and at the end he won, and everybody was just flabbergasted. And throughout the campaign he supported much of FDR's foreign policy, even though he knew it was going to hurt him politically. I mean, for example, he supported privately supported sending the 50 old destroyers to Britain. He also publicly supported something that was even more controversial, which was the introduction of a peacetime draft, the first time we had ever had that. And it was introduced into Congress during the presidential campaign in the summer of 1940. And this was something that the Republican leaders wanted him to, you know, to roundly reject. But he said it was necessary. He said it was necessary to have, you know, a strong army in case of war. And so, you know, he continued doing that after he lost. Instead of doing a disappearing act, you know, kind of like Mitt Romney, he went on the radio to tell the American people, "I lost, FDR won. He is your president, he is my president, and we will support him." And he continued doing that until we got into the war.
That's
and then afterwards, of course.
Fascinating, yeah. Bill is next in Appleton. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I saw a television program recently on the Lindbergh kidnapping and Charles Lindbergh in general. I'm sure your guest has probably seen this. A couple of their interesting points had to do with the fact that, well, maybe not the fact, but the idea that Charles Lindbergh was very much into genomics, and that was kind of like a covert reason that he went to Germany, which was covered up by his inspection of their Air Force. and that the kidnapping and murder, he was complicit in that because of the idea that his son had some type of birth defect.
Woo.
I saw that documentary, and from all the research I've done, there is absolutely nothing to support that at all. I know it's based on a book, but from everything I've learned, and I've talked to a number of people, there is no evidence at all, to support it.
I believe you, Lynn. Thank you, Bill, for the call. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Lynn Olson is our guest. She returns to the show. We talked to her last about Citizens of London, I believe. This book just released, Those Angry Days, Roosevelt, Lindbergh, and America's Fight Over World War II, 1939 to 1941. And we have a couple lines open, so feel free to take one of them, okay? This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking to Lynn Olson this hour of the program. Those Angry Days is the name of the book. How much did FDR have to get up to speed on foreign policy issues, and who helped get him up to speed? His thoughts, and of course the legislation that he championed, had been domestic issues, and he did so much in that area. Was he a little behind in his understanding of what was going on in the world, Lynn?
Yeah, I mean, I think, as I said before, not surprisingly, because he had been so focused on what was going on in this country and trying to get us out of the Depression, he obviously had not neglected foreign affairs altogether, but he had not done the same kinds of things that he had done for domestic issues, for economic issues. He was so brilliant at communicating with the American people through his fireside chats, etc., and explaining things to Americans. But he had not done that that much with what was going on in Europe, and especially the threat, the emerging threat of Hitler and Mussolini. I think part of the reason for that is that a couple of years before all this was occurring, 38, 39, he had suffered two very major political defeats, probably the worst political defeats of his whole presidency. One was when he lost his attempt to pack the Supreme mm-hmm. Court in 1937, and the second one was in 1938 when he tried to he led a campaign to defeat a number of his conservative Democratic opponents in Congress who had opposed the court packing and also a number of his New Deal programs, and he tried to get them defeated in that election, and he failed, and so this was kind of devastating for him. He had always had the feeling that the American people stood behind him. I mean, he was incredibly popular. And after that happened, he kind of lost that, at least temporarily. So I think that contributed to his hesitancy and his caution in terms of moving toward helping England and taking the kind of action that needed to be taken.
Mm-hmm.
And then once we got into the war in December 1941, the American people were suddenly all united again, and he became that incredibly bold, confident leader that he had been before. But in these 2 years, 39 to 41, he had lost some of that, and so that's one thing that contributed to the kind of the nail-biting tension about whether or not England was going to be saved, or were we going to do enough in time to save England mm-hmm. and make sure it did not go down.
And the story of what Lindbergh did during the war, you put this in the book, it's fascinating.
Once we got into World War II in December 41, he wanted to get into the American Air Force, the U.S. Air Force. He wanted to let bygones be bygones.
Right. Oh, my.
And FDR did not see it that way. FDR really thought that he had come close to treason. Lindbergh had come close to treason. He hadn't. I mean, he was exercising, whether you agreed with him or not, and most people did not agree with him at the end, he was exercising his freedom of speech. He never did anything illegal. But FDR really thought that he was thinking about basically taking over the country. He really thought he was an enemy of the country. And mm-hmm. so he said, FDR basically said, no, you're not coming, you know, we're not going to let you into the military. So instead, he became a civilian consultant to a number of airlines here in this country. And then his friends in the military, in the U.S. military, and he had a lot of friends in the U.S. military, basically said to him, why don't you come to the Pacific and act as a consultant there, civilian consultant there? And he said, well, the president would never allow it. And they basically said, well, why does the president need to know? So he went to the Pacific in the middle of the war and flew and was a civilian consultant, advised the military on aircraft and how to make them better and how to make them safer. But he also flew actual combat missions as a consultant. In fact, I believe he shot down at least one Japanese plane. And the squadron commanders and everybody else in the military out there basically, you know, turned their backs, turned their heads. You know, this was all top secret. And by all accounts, he was incredibly happy. I mean, where mm-hmm. Charles Lindbergh belonged was in a cockpit, not, mm-hmm. you know, not in, you know, in politics. And he had a wonderful time. By all accounts, he had an absolutely wonderful time during
story.
These several months when he was actually fighting. It's a great story.
Yeah, it is. Mike in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, Captain, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to mention that Charles Lindbergh has a Wisconsin connection. He attended UW-Madison, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, before he completed his world-transforming transatlantic flight, and even though he didn't graduate, I was wondering, did he ever mention how UW experienced him, influenced him and, you know, set him on the path of flight or anything like that? I'm not taking responses off the air.
I don't think he ever really talked about his experience. He dropped out, I think, in the second year. He was not at that point, he didn't like books. He didn't like studying. All he really wanted to do was fly. And so, you know, his college experience, I think, was very limited. And as far as I know, he never commented on it. Later on, he became quite, an accomplished author. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his biography, his book, it's called The Spirit of St. Louis. But I don't, at least as far as I know, that his experience in Wisconsin, it was not something that he ever really talked about.
It really is interesting that he married Anne, because she loved books. She loved writing. She was an accomplished writer and a poet, and she married somebody who was quite the opposite.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's how she got involved with this guy is fascinating. I mean, Anne Morrow Lindbergh was incredibly talented, literarily talented, and talented in many ways. But she had an incredibly big inferiority complex. She was very, very insecure, and like most young women of that time, she thought she would have loved to have been a writer. That's what she wanted to do, but she was basically brought up to believe that she had to get married. I mean, that her job was really to get married and have children, and she bought into that. And she said in high school that what she wanted to do was marry a hero. I mean, she was a big romantic. She loved the idea of Prince Charming, and who would come in and sweep her off. And so, who did she marry? She marries the biggest hero in
right,
the world.
Whole world.
Yeah, I mean, the most eligible bachelor in the world, and you know, that lovely daydream really turned into kind of a nightmare for her. Mm-hmm. I think she really loved him, but it was an extraordinarily difficult marriage from the beginning. As you point out, they were total opposites in so many ways. He was a very domineering man. He tried to control her life, and early on she let him get away with it, even though she rebelled inwardly. In her diary she would say, I hate this, I hate this. But she was brought up to be a good girl and to do, what she was supposed to do. And so she basically gave in to him, certainly early and even you know, the middle of their marriage. She changed her mind a little bit later, but so it was tough. It was really tough
right.
for her.
Yeah, George in Winneconne. Hi, George.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead, George.
Oh, I'm sorry. There was a flash on the phone. Very interesting program. A lot of contrast. One that strikes me, though, you just mentioned that Lindbergh was prevented from flying, at least officially, in Europe because of the his, did you use the word traitorous? I'm not sure. The reception wasn't that good. To describe that FDR thought his actions in meeting, going to Germany and meeting with Hitler were treasonous. If so, well, he also shares the Wisconsin history with a number of other aces from the Pacific, Richard Bong and Luther Schreiber, actually, from Oshkosh. But the point I'm really making is that FDR seems to me also broke the official, I'm sorry, the Foreign Powers Act, where he's directly dealing or approving of foreign powers doing espionage, changing U.S. policy, meddling in politics. I mean, acting like political agents, like the Russians.
Well, yes. I mean, he basically was allowing the British to get away with stuff that was illegal. There's no question about it. I didn't really say that that Lindbergh. I was not saying that Lindbergh was traitorous. I was saying that FDR considered him to be close to being a traitor. Probably considered him to be a traitor. But you know, just to repeat what I said, he wasn't. He was not a traitor.
Yeah. Let's go back to that where you start the book. That soft morning in April of 1939, the meeting between FDR and Charles Lindbergh. It's beautifully described. What was the meeting all about?
Lindbergh had just come back just a few days before from his long stay in Europe, and FDR invited him to the White House, basically, I think, to take his measure. He knew what Lindbergh had been doing in Europe had been well publicized. That, you know, he had talked about the German Air Force being overwhelming, that Germany was overwhelming, France and Britain couldn't possibly win, etc. So, you know, if in the event of a war, the war hadn't yet broken out, but he knew that Charles Lindbergh could be a real threat to any attempts that FDR made to help England and France, which is when he invited Lindbergh to the White House, he had just begun kind of his first effort to help England and France get weapons from us. So he invited Lindbergh to the White House just to see what he was like. And it was the first and only time the two of them ever met. I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall for that.
Oh, yes.
Because they both, you know, they had a history that went back 5 years. They had been involved in another issue 5 years before in which Lindbergh had really bested FDR in kind of a public relations thing. And so FDR, you know, was really resentful of Lindbergh, and I think that helped contribute to the bitterness of the relations, or, you know, the confrontation that the two of them had later on.
And that was the thing about flying mail, and can you describe that? Lindbergh was right about it, right?
Yeah, basically FDR, this is the year after he had become president, at the height of his popularity, he had canceled airmail delivery contracts that had been granted to the country's largest airlines by Herbert Hoover, who was FDR's predecessor, Republican predecessor. And FDR said, claimed that there had been fraud and bribery involved in the granting of those contracts. Lindbergh immediately publicly challenged FDR and said that he had not given the airlines time to a chance to respond before canceling those contracts. And then he also said that it was a really bad idea. FDR had basically assigned the delivery of mail from then on to the U.S. Air Corps, the Air Force. And Lindbergh, who had been an airmail pilot himself, said that was really awful because these young military pilots did not have the experience to fly this hazardous mission. You know, it was very, very dangerous to deliver for these airmail pilots. You know, they flew in all kinds of weather,
right.
Blizzards, etc. And as it turned out, what Lindbergh predicted was right. I mean, there were like 66 crashes.
Goodness gracious.
15 deaths and a lot of humiliation for the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And So very soon thereafter, the airline companies began flying the mail again. But it was really the first PR defeat for FDR.
Yeah. Oh, I could talk to you all day. I love your book. You just pick these moments that are so fascinating and write about them so well. Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you, Kathleen, very much.
Lynn Olson, the book is Those Angry Days, Roosevelt, Lindbergh, and America's Fight Over World War II, 1939 to 1941. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Katie Madsen for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Until tomorrow, great talks ahead.